This program is brought to you by Fresh FM.
This is Dana Wensley, and you're listening to Top Writers. Today I'm interviewing local author Jean Gorman about At the King's Pleasure, a heady mix of romance, adventure, and action, set in the times of Richard the Lionheart. Before we talk to Jean, I want to take a few moments to talk about freedom of speech. I'm the Freedom of Speech spokesperson for PEN in New Zealand. PEN is a worldwide organisation that promotes literature and freedom of speech. I believe that words have power, that images have power. Freedom of speech is all about whether you believe that power should be restrained. In previous shows, I've talked about authors whose names are well known, people like Booker Prize winner Salman Rushdie, and about New Zealand author Ted Dorr, who wrote the book that was banned in New Zealand for a few weeks last year called Into the River. But there are many more writers whose names you will never hear, whose writing you will never know because they're persecuted for their work. Each year, PEN International produces a case list of persecuted writers. From January 2015 to December 2015, there were 1,054 writers brought to PEN's attention. The music you hear today is recorded from Manus Island Regional Processing Centre in Papua New Guinea. The guitarist is Farad, a Kurdish painter, guitar maker and player. The voices of Behrouz Bouchani, who has been incarcerated on Manus Island for almost 3 years. Bouchani is one writer out of the 1,054 writers I could have chosen to talk to you about today. He is a journalist and human rights advocate. An Iranian national in his native Iran, Bouchani worked as a journalist for several newspapers. He was passionate about the revival of Kurdish language and culture, and for many years Bouchani would secretly teach children and adults their mother language, a particular Kurdish dialect from the region he was from. The recording playing now is of Bouchani singing in this Kurdish dialect. In Iran, Bouchani was subject to constant surveillance, and in 2013 he was reportedly arrested, interrogated, and threatened by the Iranian intelligence services. Fearing that he would be imprisoned, he fled Iran on 13th of May 2013 and was rescued at sea by the Australian Navy, whom he asked for asylum. According to PEN's information, Bouchani was taken to Manus Island Regional Processing Centre in Papua New Guinea. Here he faced harassment for reporting to the Australian media and other organisations on conditions inside the detention centre and human rights abuses alleged to be taking place there. He reports being the target of beatings as a direct result of his reporting. Since his detention, Bouchani has been documenting human rights violations, which he passes on to the humanitarian research partners, who in turn pass the information on to the United Nations and its relevant agencies. Bouchani continues to write for several publications while in detention, and has published the first instalment of his book, documenting his experiences in detention. PEN's case list provides information on other writers like Bouchani. It has a breakdown of writers by country and a further indication of field of work. Journalists, bloggers, and those involved in digital media are prominent in this year's list, and it makes a chilling read of statistics. This is just one story of one writer. If you want to find out more about what PEN does and how you can be involved, follow the links on the New Zealand Society of Authors website to PEN, or contact me, Dana Wensley, at pen@nzauthors.org.nz.
This show is sponsored by the Top of the South Writers, a branch of the New Zealand Society of Authors. Top of the South Writers is devoted to the interests of writers in the region. It offers talks, workshops, a weekly newsletter, advice about publishing and copyright issues, and much more. You can find out more about Top of the South Writers at topwriters.co.nz.
This is Dana Wensley, and you're listening to Top Writers. Today I'm interviewing local author Jean Gorman about her book, At the King's Pleasure. Originally from England, Jean is an active member of the Top of the South branch of the New Zealand Society of Authors. She now writes from an olive grove near Nelson, and her books are an epic mix of romance, humour and action. Thanks for coming into the Founders Park studio to talk with me today, Jean.
Pleasure.
At the King's Pleasure is one of those reads that draws you along. It's got great villains, a well-researched historical setting, a heroine who is a protagonist that I think most women would identify with, and a romantic hero that I have to say is so convoluted he would give Heathcliff a run for his money. Tell us about At the King's Pleasure in your own words.
Well, it's the second book that I've written, and the first one was on the same period about the Lionheart. The Lionheart was King Richard of England. He was never called Richard the First. He's always referred to as the Lionheart. I decided on a significant period that's little known. Richard the Lionheart, King of England, left for Normandy after the Crusades to be revenged on the French King Philippe, who had actually organised his capture and ransom by the Germans. And he actually never returned. So most English history books just leave him at that point, you know, and Richard sailed for France and then died 5 years later, you know, end of story. But actually the next 6 weeks was a very important part of history in which he nearly captured Philippe, and had he done so, the history of England would have been changed quite radically.
It's an interesting read because it is set in that 6 weeks, isn't it?
And it's
a bit of romance, but there's also a lot of action. There's also a lot of the war strategy in it. So tell us more about the particular story.
Montclair was one of Richard's knights, and by some skullduggery, the heroine's brother had stolen his lands. He'd produced some paperwork which was false, and it wasn't like him, but it had been a bit of skullduggery played on Montclair by some of the other characters. But then her brother had been killed, and so she was left in the unfortunate position of having inherited these lands, and he was not best pleased. So there's a sort of tension between them right from the start. She is very quickly taken to be the one of the attendants of Queen Eleanor. And the rest of the story really devolves around the way that Eleanor and Richard left England, went to France, and how the battles went on, and the heroine Diana and Montclair the knight get pushed together from time to time, and sort of their story evolves with the actual history.
Mm. I think it evolves well. I really like how there's the two things going on at once. And your protagonist, who you've said is Diana, she's a really strong character, which I enjoyed reading. She has everything, but she has it all taken away in a twist of fate, as you say. Yet she doesn't give up. And when I was reading it, I felt like she was a 21st century woman plunged into this medieval era where women are chattels and they have no rights at all. Mm. So tell us about the role of women in medieval society.
It was certainly, it's a problem for the writer as well as for the medieval woman, because to write about a woman whose only role is to keep the keys of the castle and make sure the victuals keep coming for the men, it's not going to make much of a story. So I always have to think of some particular reason which throws them into a different situation from the normal for my heroines. Eleanor of Aquitaine was the most interesting of women. She was the mother of King Richard. She was married to Henry II of England, and They were, I wouldn't say happily married, but they stayed married until she encouraged her sons to revolt against, they had such a family argument, revolted against their father, at which point he threw her into prison. And she stayed there for 16 years until he died. So Richard was brought up in his mother's court, whereas John and the others were brought up with their father. Or the younger ones, anyway. John was the youngest, and so he was brought up by his father. His father took no notice of him, and so it was servants who looked after him all the time. And he just could do what he wanted. There were never any consequences. The servants had to do what he said. And so he grew up very badly behaved. And that never changed. So he ended up being called Bad King John. He ended up being king simply because of the mortality in those days. You know, the previous four sons, who would have thought the fourth or fifth son could ever inherit? But the most tragic loss for Eleanor would have been the loss of her firstborn at the age of three. You know, to have a son in those days was just you know, that's what women were for, you know, and having a son, to have him, you know, he died of probably measles or something fairly ordinary. At the age of three, it must have been absolutely heartbreaking. But she was a powerful woman. You know, she had been born as the heir of the Duke of Aquitaine, and that was why she was married by Henry. She had an interesting history. She'd been married to Philippe's father, Philippe of France. But she had managed to get him to divorce her because they just did not get on at all. And she had made it something that he did. She couldn't divorce him, but she'd got, you know, organised it so that he divorced her. And within 2 months, Henry of England married her and thereby got Aquitaine. You know, he was already Duke of Normandy, so most of France actually belonged to England then.
That comes across in the book. All the history is just embedded throughout the book, and I struggled at times to keep my head above it all, particularly when it got to all the action scenes and who was on whose side, and the villains are always crossing and changing sides, and I want to talk to you more about that later. But each show I ask my guests what song they want to play, and you've chosen something from the period, haven't you? Tell us about what you've chosen.
Well, it's lute music, because Richard was very good musician. And he was a rounded man in that way. He spoke several languages, though his native language would have been Languedoc, which isn't spoken much now except right down in the Pyrenees. He did speak English, though many of the nobility didn't. They spoke the same language as we would speak French now. I can understand medieval French, or English as it was in those days, just because I can understand French. And it's pretty much the same language. So he was very well educated. He spoke Latin. And he actually, when he was put on trial by the Germans, he decided to speak Latin, because had he spoken French, he would have used a translator. They would have used a translator who would not have told the court what he'd really said.
Let's hear that piece of music now.
Thank you.
This is Dana Wensley, and you're listening to Top Writers. Today I'm talking to local writer Jean Gorman about At the King's Pleasure, the second book in a series called The Lionheart Chronicles. Now, music plays an important role in the book. I'm thinking of the scene when Richard the Lionheart consents to Montclair marrying Diana, and they play this beautiful lute duet together. And it's somewhat incongruous because they've just had a day of bloody fighting. I mean, you describe these scenes in such intricate detail, and then they sit down and play this beautiful romantic lute music. So tell us about the role of music in medieval times.
Because of the influence of Eleanor of Aquitaine, there had been a code of chivalry set in place. Because she well understood the operation of a court, and when she set up her own court in Poitiers and in Aquitaine, she had a problem, because if we think arrogant, entitled behaviour is a problem today, it's nothing compared to those days when violence was a normal way to solve a dispute. Noblemen at court, especially young knights, would often behave shockingly badly, especially towards women. So she set up her court and instigated the novel idea of chivalry. Music and poetry were held as important as being able to wield a sword. And might is right was the absolutely what went down in those days.
Mm.
And Richard was brought up in this environment of education mattering and playing. And he was charming, well-educated. He was an excellent lute player, well-versed in the art of law, of war rather, because his father sent him out to subdue the rebellious lords of Aquitaine when they stuck their noses up above the parapet. His men had a great respect for him, but he could behave like a four-year-old when crossed.
Mm.
I mean, he was likewise brought up in this, you know, he always got what he wanted because he was the heir apparent Duke of Aquitaine.
A lot of the characters come across like that, like the hero. You know, in the beginning he wants to murder Diana or, you know, worse. I'm not sure exactly what's going through his mind the first scene. And it's not until halfway through the book that he decides that he's actually not going to kill her to get his lands back.
Mm.
So it is interesting. The characters are very complex, and I get the sense that this is what it was like at the time, that anyone who had a hankering for this medieval period, I think by chapter two, would quickly decide that It wasn't all to live then. Yeah, it wasn't all fun, there just doesn't seem to be any ethics really, except for, as you say, this code of chivalry that seems to run through it. But it's a very thin vein of morality. Yeah. As far as I can see, it is right,
and I certainly wouldn't have wanted to live in those days. It would have, especially as a woman. And if you were a man and not well built and, you know, well versed in fighting, then again, life would have been short and not very sweet and very uncomfortable. I mean, look at the modern warmth and food that we accept as normal. Yeah. And most people went through most of their lives cold and hungry. Mm-hmm.
Now tell us about the second piece of music you want to play today.
It's a piece of Mozart. It's because I very much enjoyed that. It's a Baroque music. It's the concerto for, was it harp?
Clarinet.
Clarinet and orchestra, that's the one, 688, yeah.
Thank you.
This is Dana Wensley and you're listening to Top Writers. Today I'm interviewing Jean Gorman about her book, At the King's Pleasure. Jean, you've had an interesting life, like most writers that I'm learning. You've done a bit of everything. Your bio says you've worked in intensive care at a hospital, made a home in an ancient Welsh school, and served as a physics teacher. So I'm curious how you ended up writing medieval novels.
It was a period I had studied. My first novel started out in the wilds of Wales, and I knew a lot about Wales. We lived there for many years. And I chose it because it was a place where my characters could do what they want, or what I wanted them to do, without the intervention of much law or any strict manners and behaviours like you would have had if you tried to write in the Regency period. You do have to know an awful lot about what people were and weren't allowed to do or say for that period. So I thought, well, it would give me a lot of freedom with my writing. The first book was really the reason why I chose a defined period of history for the second, because the first book spanned about 3 years, and it's a lot more. It growed like Topsy, rather than being planned. This is where it will start, and this is where it will end. It was like uncovering a fossil. Was that first book? Mm. It was just there, and I would sit down to read. To write in the same way as if I was sitting down to read, because I didn't know what was going to happen next. But it was most enjoyable writing.
Well, that's fascinating. Each time I try to ask writers about the parts they cut or the sections they found the toughest to write. And after reading At the King's Pleasure, I think you pretty much tackle most subjects that scare less experienced writers. Your book deals with murder, rape and brutality, of which there was much at the time. But it actually still comes across as an enjoyable read, as odd as that sounds. Which were the hardest parts for you to write, and how, as a female writer, did you get into the minds of those ruthless villains?
The hardest, yeah, it's hard to write about the fighting, and I had to actually go to experts in sword fighting to find out how they used their broadswords, because you know, you read things that aren't very well informed, and you think that they couldn't really move them around much because they were so heavy, but actually they could. They were trained to it. They had the muscles for it, and the same way as archers, they could bend a bow, which most men today couldn't even begin to bend because they had trained right from the age of 7 onwards. So you certainly had to go to experts on sword fighting to find out about the fighting. But the most enjoyable parts to write are the dialogues, things like when one person just is not listening to the other, and the comments they're making are going straight past each other. That's quite sort of amusing. And or the interplay between characters, especially if you're setting up a romantic tension or you're bringing out an undercurrent of what they're not saying.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's great fun to write.
Yeah, I think that comes across well. How do you write your dialogue, or how did you learn to write it, or does it just come naturally?
It just comes out. I know where the conversation has got to lead. I know what the outcome has got to be. And I just write it until we get there.
Yeah, I really like that, and I really like the tension between Moncler and Diana, and I think you do that well. And the first kiss, I think, is when he's actually wearing a monk's robe, isn't it?
He's disguised because someone's likely to chop his head off. Yes, if he's found out where he is.
Yeah, it's a very interesting romance. So we've got a few minutes left, but I want to ask you what you're working on now.
I'm working on the King's Ransom, which is when King Richard was captured in Germany by the Holy Roman Emperor, who, as Voltaire famously said, was neither Holy Roman nor an emperor. And he was another of these really cruel and unpleasant powerful rulers. His father was Barbarossa, who was Redbeard, who had no time for him. And Henry's psyche suffered from his father's rejection. He wanted to prove he was better than his father and show his power always, however cruel he was. He decided to extend the boundaries of his empire to prove a point. He was cold, calculating, narcissistic and ruthless, and devolving to vindictive and cruel. So his first move to world domination was to invade Sicily is his wife, Constance, had a claim to the throne. He was absolutely horrible to the Sicilians who had opposed him and was cruel to the child who had been king, killed him. It wasn't long before Constance realised that she was now no longer useful to him. She'd provided him with an excuse to claim the crown of Sicily, which he now had, and a healthy son and heir, and now being a bit past childbearing, she realised that she would be the next to go. That would leave him free to marry another heiress and annex another country, which was how life went in those days.
It sounds like it's going to be another thrilling historical read. How far through are you?
I'm about halfway through, but since my mother died, his family things have overtaken my life, so it's been in abeyance for about a year.
Mm. Well, hopefully you'll be able to get that finished soon. What was the title of it?
It's called The King's Ransom.
Mm. Well, thank you so much for being here. We're out of time, but it's been a really interesting read and very interesting to talk to you today. So thank you, Jean, for coming along.
Thank you, Dana.
You can find out more about the Lionheart Chronicles and where to buy them on the internet at the Top of the South Writers website at www.topwriters.co.nz. You can buy Jean's book at The King's Pleasure at Page and Blackmore. You'll also find links to Jean's blog, which details her travels around France following the footsteps of Richard the Lionheart and his journeys, and some wonderful photos that you took on your travels, Jean. They're on her website at medievalauthor.com.
This show is sponsored by the Top of the South Writers, a branch of the New Zealand Society of Authors. You can find out more about Top of the South Writers at topwriters.co.nz.
Thanks to New Zealand On Air for making this program available through funding the Access Internet Radio Project. Cheers, New Zealand On Air.